Hello, everybody, and welcome to December's edition of AZMcast. I want to thank you guys for bearing with us while we waited to put this out. I know it took a while, and I appreciate all the emails hoping Jared and I were okay. I'm a little unnerved of how many of you thought that Jared and I got this illness by, shall we say, unsavory methods. Anyway, we're better, it's out, and here we go. So before we start the section on vaginal bleeding, I just want to say that here on AZMcast, we try to keep a level of decorum, a level of professionalism and sophistication so that we can talk about issues like this that are serious issues, so that we can discuss them in a stoic and reasonable manner for the betterment of our patients. And honestly, we just didn't feel that humor in this kind of a setting would be appropriate. So, since it's OB-GYN month, we wanted to talk about vaginal bleeding, but of course Jared can't help but talk about the airway, even when we're talking about vaginal bleeding. So you want to tell your story from today?
Yeah, so I'm rounding in the ICU and I have a patient that needs to be intubated. She was going to be fairly difficult, so we decided to give ketamine. And we give her like 50 milligrams of ketamine, and she lays back and says, "A huge blood clot just fell out of my vagina." And I'm sitting there thinking, that's interesting. That's an interesting hallucination. So I pull the sheet back, and sure enough, a huge blood clot fell out of her vagina.
True story. You can't make that stuff up. Well, so much for decorum and professionalism. I'm just going to lean into it now. This month's edition of AZMcast is brought to you by the word discharge. Discharge. It's either the best word or the worst word you've heard all day. So we're going to talk about vaginal bleeding. We're not going to talk about I'm spotting, I think this might be my period. We're not going to talk about super bad.
Calling all units, armed and dangerous man in the vicinity.
Back up! There's so much blood!
We're going to talk about real vaginal bleeding, the it's in my shoes and you should be peeing yourself vaginal bleeding. So if you've never had one of these, you'd be surprised at how much blood can actually come out of the vagina. So besides your airway breathing circulation, we're going to talk about the next steps of management. So now we're going to talk with Kevin Riley and do a quick little discussion with him, quick case, and then just some of the finer points to get his opinion from his experience. So this is a 35-year-old female that comes in, and she had the onset of vaginal bleeding about an hour ago. She's tachy to 130. She looks pale. You fold her eyelids back, and you can see right through them. And she has blood all over her jeans, all the way down to the bottom. So in your mind, while everybody else is kind of checking her airway and listening to her heart, what's going on in your mind as far as your next steps that you're thinking?
So my first thought is resuscitation of the patient. It looks like she's profoundly anemic. If she's pale, I tend to look at the eyes and the hands and compare the hand to my hand and see the degree of pallor next to my hand. That's a good way for me to judge how anemic they are. It's not 100%, but it gets you pretty quickly to the idea that they're profoundly anemic. And that usually means a hematocrit around 15 if their hand is completely pale. And so you need access, you need the patient cross-matched, you need blood pressure and heart rate assessment, and then the next step is, do you give uncross-matched blood? I know the gynecologists who deal with young, healthy people that are profoundly anemic tend to have a much lower threshold for transfusion, but I think if the patient's in shock when they present, you need to get O negative blood and start transfusing right away. And the next step probably would be to use a fast and make sure there's no free fluid in the abdomen from a ruptured ectopic. Some degree of vaginal bleeding might occur with that also. But typically it's some type of uterine pathology. And I've had one case of a teenager with her first coitus at the drive-in that had a vaginal laceration and came in the similar degree of shock.
So obviously the first step is stabilization, just like you had said. We get my favorite labs, the quickest labs you can get in the emergency department, a finger stick followed by the VBG with lights and lactate. I always love those. And a lot of people don't realize that that VBG will also give you a hemoglobin that's estimated on it, which is a nice thing to go off of. And then the other most important test that I found in these cases, you and I actually had one of these together, Kevin, where we had the shocky ectopic that I remember the first thing we did is walk in, look at the patient, look at her eyes, and then we had the nurse take the pants off and do a cath UA, because that is going to be very divergent of positive pregnancy, negative pregnancy. So for our case that we had, the resident came down and said, oh yeah, definitely, we got to get going, we got to move, but unfortunately my attending's not here. So in the case of someone who's hemorrhaging from the vagina, we need to do some stabilizing measures. If she were lucky enough to get lacerated across the carotid or to have some other kind of bleed that we could put some pressure on, it'd be nice to do that. But it's kind of hard to find the area, find the source to put pressure on it. So if you've got someone that's hemorrhaging, what kind of steps do you take? Do you pack the vagina? Do you do anything else, any medications that you would recommend?
So I think the first thing you got to do is take a look, and it's difficult but not impossible to do a pelvic exam on an inverted bedpan and get an idea, is this a vaginal bleeding source or uterine? Packing the vagina is sometimes like putting a big dressing on. It doesn't leak out until you've saturated the dressing with 3 liters of blood, but that really hasn't helped the patient. It's just prevented the blood from coming out and alarming the clinician. So I think if it's a vaginal laceration, packing the vagina is probably helpful because it does put some direct pressure on that. If it's a uterine source, I'm not sure that that's going to help a lot, but it doesn't hurt and it gives you some additional information.
Kind of in your experience, have you ever used anything like methergen or IV estrogen, anything like that, to try to slow it down, or do you usually get the consultation with the gynecologist first?
I've used methergen when it's an abortion situation, and I've used estrogen once in conjunction with the GYN consultants, but I haven't used those by myself. Luckily, most of the times that I've been in small community hospitals, I've not had this problem. It's only been when I've been in the university setting where I have excellent backup.
So, Jared, I'm going to ask you, from a similar vein, not exactly related to massive vaginal bleeding, but let's say that we get the first lady that comes in where she's bleeding into her socks, we get her hemoglobin back and it's 4, we're definitely going to want to transfuse her. Let's say that this is actually someone who's had prolonged vaginal bleeding. It's been going on for about 3 weeks or so, just been steady, and now she's looking pale. And this has gone on over a long period of time. What is your cutoff for transfusing someone who's got more of a chronic anemia process versus our lady that was acute? Because I know some of these women, if you try to rush the blood in too fast, you can cause problems. Do you want to comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, I guess it brings up a bigger issue in that just because somebody's anemic doesn't mean they're in shock. So I like to break the vag bleeding patients into, are they in shock or are they not in shock? And what I mean by that is, are they in hemorrhagic shock because they're acutely losing their blood volume from their female genitourinary tract? Or have they been bleeding for a long time? Maybe they're perimenopausal, maybe they have a bleeding fibroid, and they've been bleeding over 3 weeks and now their hemoglobin's 4. They may be making lactate and have a little degree of shock because of decreased oxygen delivery, but most of them are fairly stable. They're just a little tachycardic and pale, like your patient that you had with Kevin. So in that case, when you have somebody who has a hemoglobin of 4 and it's been 3 weeks that it's taken them to get to that hemoglobin, if they're making lactate, I would probably try to bring them up to 7. If they're not making lactate, I'd maybe bring them up to 6 and see how they do. Because if they have any element of cardiovascular disease, you could give them pulmonary edema, you could give them cardiac overload. And there's really no rush to bring them back up to normal. You just want to bring them back up to oxygen delivery standards.
Since I'm an old doctor, I don't really need any tests, because when I started practicing, there weren't tests. But I like to shake the patient's hand, and if it's cold and clammy, I think that tells you about the shock process. And if they're cold and clammy, I start blood, and usually 2 units of blood will bring them up enough to get them out of shock until you have more information, and then you have to make decisions about further transfusion and whether you need other types of blood products. But I think if they're in shock, you really ought to return them some blood that they've been dripping out onto the floor.
Yeah, this is kind of like the GI bleeder, the upper GI bleeder who's been bleeding out for a while. Now his hemoglobin's 4. And if they're not in shock, and you think about their hemoglobin being 4, if that's a 3 or 4-fold decrease in hemoglobin, you have to have a 3 or 4-fold increase in cardiac output to maintain your oxygen delivery. So they're going to have high output heart failure. And if you give them a whole bunch of blood, you're just going to give them pulmonary edema and make the situation worse. So I think 2 units is fine, but I wouldn't go from a hemoglobin of 4 to 10 as your goal. I would just give them a little bit.
As Kevin mentioned, you know, before you had diagnostic tests, it was really hard to wait for the rabbit to die in the emergency department to diagnose pregnancy. So your physical exam is still paramount to be able to tell you what's going on.
The packing the vagina thing is an interesting dilemma because the pelvis is shaped to not be compressible unless it's fractured, and that's why the binders work. But if you have an intact pelvic bony structure, it's not compressible. So I had a patient one time with Ken when he was working on his book that was a uterine fibroid that was bleeding, and he took a Trojan condom and put a Foley catheter in it and put it through the cervix into the uterus and instilled saline through it to blow up the condom to turn into a balloon. So that's something you could do if Joshi or somebody's around, get the condom from them and put a Foley catheter in it.
Seriously, we're not even trying to keep it professional anymore. I'm just going to say right now, if that's my patient, please don't insert a condom into my patient in any way, shape, or form while in the emergency department. Thank you. So I think Kevin's summary was very good. First thing you need to do is recognize, is this patient in shock or not? The next thing you need to do is determine the source of the bleeding, like Jared had talked about. You need to actually get in there. You need to get some suction. You need to get some of that Curlex, and you need to figure out where the source of the bleeding is so you can actually say intelligently to your consultant, they're bleeding from a laceration, which is something we're able to do, is fix vaginal lacerations. Or, no, it's bleeding from the cervix. No, it's bleeding from the cervical os. It helps us to figure out what's going on. If you do need to pack the vagina, you can give it a shot, and usually you take a roll of Curlex, you grab it with the ring forceps, and you really have to stuff down deeply. Remember to aim posteriorly, because that's the track the vagina naturally takes, and you always want to leave a tail out. So if you get to the end of your Curlex roll, grab another roll, and that way you have an idea of not only how many packs you put in there, but you have tampon theory where you're able to pull it back out because there's a tail hanging out. You want to know if they're pregnant or not, because that's going to determine whether they need the OR ready right now versus somebody that's going to need another exam when they get there.
If it's a vaginal bleed and you can't fix the laceration and they're hemorrhaging and you're putting Curlex in there, maybe you could soak it in epi before you put it in there.
It's not a bad idea. They always do that. They do the Lido with epi injections before they do LEAP procedures, and I know it makes the patient a little more tachycardic. They definitely do get the systemic feel, but not a bad idea if you're trying to clamp down the bleeding. I'm gonna pop some tags. Only got $20 in my pocket. I'm looking for a come up. This is trolling the web. So Jared and I every once in a while get an email from somebody that wants us to discuss something, and usually they're good ideas. So we're going to take one of the ones from Merlin Curry, who sends us stuff regularly. Thanks for being a fan, Merlin. He wanted us to talk about ACEP's Choose Wisely guidelines that they came out with in October 14th of this year. So what ACEP did was they developed 5 Choose Wisely recommendations that they took input from different ASEP members, a bunch of expert panel emergency physicians, the ASEP board of directors, and they wanted to figure out what five things can we try to encourage as a national group so that people will make good decisions that are both good for the patient, good for ED flow, good for the healthcare system as a whole, and try to have a little bit of backing from the college about that. So the five that were actually decided by ASEP are as follows. The first one was, please avoid computer tomography scans of the head in emergency department patients with minor head injury who are at low risk based on validated decision rules. Number two, avoid placing Foley catheters in patients in the emergency department for either urine output monitoring in stable patients who can void on their own, or for patient or staff convenience. Number three was don't delay in engaging available palliative and hospice services in the emergency department for patients that may benefit from this. Avoid antibiotics and wound cultures in emergency department patients with uncomplicated skin and soft tissue abscesses after a successful incision and drainage with adequate medical follow-up. And the last one was avoid instituting IV fluids before doing a trial of oral rehydration therapy in uncomplicated emergency department cases of mild to moderate dehydration in kids. Most of these actually sound pretty straightforward, and I think that we do a fairly good job of doing all these, but we're just going to discuss these real quick. This happens in my line of work all the time, avoiding head CTs in patients that have had minor head injuries. How many kids run into a dresser at full speed and really don't need a head CT unless they're somehow related to Usain Bolt? So they're not going to crack their head open. They're not going to cause a bleed. So we don't need to scan these kids. And we've got very well-validated decision tools now, like PCARN for kids and Canadian Head CT Rule in New Orleans for adults, that will help us to not scan patients that don't need it. One of the things that I always like to point out about PCARN is just because they're not completely negative by PCARN, still does not mean we have to scan them. This is not an either-or thing with this kind of a decision rule. If they have one criteria that's not quite off, then you can't use PCARN. Doesn't mean you have to scan them.
Yeah, when I reflect back on how I practice, and you know, it's mostly adults, and so I tend to scan more heads than I probably should, and somebody who maybe wrecks their bike and had a little loss of consciousness or something that you could just observe for a couple hours and not scan their head. And you know, it's a slippery slope because you think, oh, if I'm scanning their head, maybe I'll just slip down and do their C-spine too. And we probably waste a lot of resources by doing that. And yeah, you know, the Choosing Wisely campaign for radiology actually suggests not getting CT angios, CT pulmonary angios for emergency department patients to rule out pulmonary embolism. And so that's another discussion that we could have at another time. But these other organizations are also trying to influence our practice with these Choosing Wisely guidelines.
And so I think that if we can have a good reaction to some of these guidelines, we can prevent having other institutions come in and tell us how to practice. So for kids, the recommendation is actually just to monitor them. You watch these kids in the emergency department, you make sure they're eating, you make sure they're not throwing up, you make sure that they're active and playful, and they can go home, and you give them closed head injury instructions. Because what we're ultimately trying to avoid is giving these kids cancer down the line. And there's some evidence that's starting to emerge that maybe you can calculate medical radiation risk and correlate it to cancer later on in life. But all in all, you still need to remember who's low risk and who's high risk. The pendulum may have swung too far one way or another when people are afraid to scan someone that may be a victim of child abuse. So the mortality rate from missed child abuse is far higher than the mortality rate from the cancer we may be giving kids with CTs. So always think outside the box from these decision rules in a case like that.
Yeah, I would say just scan the people who need it, not because you're afraid to miss something.
So I think the cancer card is an excellent thing for emergency physicians because parents don't want to give their kids cancer. And let's face it, in the past, we would say, I think we can watch your child, and parents would demand a CT. And I think now we have a new tool in our armamentarium, and that's the cancer card.
Yeah, it's kind of like the white blood cell count in your appendicitis. If it works to your advantage, go ahead and use it. If it doesn't, then don't use it. because you don't want to have to turn around and say, actually, now your kid does need a scan, but I thought we were going to give him cancer. Well, he may get cancer, but he may also have a head bleed. Choose wisely how you describe your choose wisely decision. So the second one, avoid placing indwelling urinary catheters in patients for either urine output monitoring in somebody who is stable and can void on their own, or for patient or staff convenience. I think pretty often we have nurses come in and say, hey, can I put a Foley in that lady with the hip fracture? But what they're recommending is to try to avoid this, because what are we trying to avoid again? Catheter-associated urinary tract infections. These can be bad, and this prolongs hospital stay. Medicare is going to start taking cuts with some of these hospital-associated complications. And we don't want the patients doing any worse than when they came in. We want them to be getting better. So their indications for a catheter, as far as ASEPs choose widely guidelines go, is output monitoring for critically ill patients. So if you've got a critically ill patient and you need to check their urine output as a sign of perfusion, go for it. If they have a urinary obstruction, they have a huge prostate or something else like that, a bladder stricture, they are going to need it. At the time of surgery and during end-of-life care, these are the selections that they've decided. Is it inconvenient for the lady with the hip fracture to have to try to pee on a bedpan? Well, is it inconvenient for her to get pilo from her Foley catheter?
Yeah, so we usually try to get Foleys out as soon as possible, and we'll even bladder scan and straight cath every 3 hours if we have to. If somebody gets a urinary tract infection from an indwelling catheter, that's thought to be our fault, in which case the entire visit is free.
So, number three, don't delay engaging available palliative and hospital and hospice care services in the emergency department for patients who are likely to benefit. Michelle Rhodes is somewhere just grinning and jumping up and down happily. So palliative care is a great resource, and we have a great benefit to be able to have this. There are those patients that where you have to have a very difficult discussion with the family, and sometimes their best use of our resources is to get them where they're ultimately going to be. Jerry, when you see these people that come up to the ICU, how many of them do you think maybe could have gone directly to palliative care if it was made a little more available?
That's a tough question to answer. This probably would take another whole hour to discuss, but I would say it's probably a small percentage of people that we could have sent to home hospice or palliative care. One of the things that is hard about emergency medicine is to not be the judge, jury, and executioner and separate what you feel about the situation from what the family feels or the patient might feel. And so I think it's going to be up to people like Rhodes to really decide how we can do palliative care in the emergency department.
Funny you should mention that, because I ran into her in the cafeteria today and I told her we're going to have her on whether she likes it or not to talk about some of these difficult decisions. So. So if you have a patient that you think may benefit, and like Jared said, that doesn't mean that we decide this is a lost cause, but we have a discussion with the family, the patient is DNR, DNI, allow natural death, whichever term that they're using, we try to get palliative care on board first. And sometimes that's most easily done in the emergency department by talking to case management and social work. They're really our inroads into that field of medicine. So if you have somebody you think will benefit, talk with them early. All right, so another one, avoid antibiotics and wound cultures in emergency department patients with uncomplicated skin and soft tissue abscesses after you've successfully IND'd and they have adequate medical follow-up. So Harvey Meislin was on the original paper that described that you don't need to give antibiotics when you IND. That being said, I see lots of people give antibiotics for abscesses. And why is that? It's because we're all afraid of MRSA. MRSA is kind of that strange bug, but there's still evidence to show that if you appropriately IND, it will sometimes resolve by its own. It will often resolve by its own. But I still get a little scared, and I will still more often than not give antibiotics. So this is one of the ones that I do poorly. What about you, Jared?
I do terrible at this. I can't even tell you how many times I've prescribed antibiotics, because it's just about almost every time you do Bactrim and Keflex or clindamycin after you've drained it. And you know, I'm scared of the adequate follow-up thing. I've been burned by that before, so I'm probably as guilty as the next person about this one. What about you, Kevin?
I have to say that I'm a total wimp also, but I'm changing my tune. Those of you that listen to this, and I say, go ahead and give some antibiotics, I want you to challenge me on that because I think I'm wrong.
So this is the perfect example of the guidelines say this, and it takes a while for people to catch up to it. The culture thing, I don't usually culture it, because whether or not it's MRSA, I treat it as if it's MRSA. I was always taught that everything is MRSA until proven otherwise, because that's just the culture we live in. The people I will culture, though, ironically enough, are the IV drug abusers, because these are the people that use dirty needles, and they end up with those strange anaerobic infections, the HACCP organisms. I had an IV drug user that I IND'd her abscess, and I looked it up later, and she had Kingella and some kind of like group C strep, something weird that you wouldn't expect. And it looked like MRSA, thought it would be, but this is what you would see in someone who would abuse IV drugs. So that's the one patient that I do say, you know, I think we should probably check, because who knows if they're licking their needles before they're sticking them in.
Well, that begs the question, is that an uncomplicated abscess? What's the definition of an uncomplicated abscess versus a complicated? I'd say if you think it's a IV drug user with a dirty needle, maybe that's not uncomplicated.
Yeah. So ACEP's guidelines say that even in abscesses caused by MRSA, appropriately selected antibiotics offer no benefit if the abscess has been adequately drained and the patient has a well-functioning immune system. So how much of the pus do you think you get out when you go in and you have a screaming patient that does not have their abscess completely anesthetized? I'm always worried I didn't get it all. So rather than subject the patient to appropriate therapy, I give them antibiotics.
Yeah, I'm probably the same. You make a big whack and you try to probe around in there and break up the loculations, but we never look and see if we got it all out or broke up all the loculations. So Bactrim Keflex.
Shrikar does.
Ketamine. That's what I say. Ketamine and aggressively drain. If it's bigger than probably a quarter, you probably need to knock them out and do it under sedation. I guess a quarter's a little too small, but...
One of our nurses, Kelly, she just left here this summer, and she now works at a hospital in Alabama, and she called me to ask me if there was literature behind that, because at her hospital, they will not do an IND without conscious sedation.
Those are much nicer people. I hope when I get my abscess, that's where I'm going. We're horrible, horrible people here sometimes. All right, so, you know, you see these guidelines, and we talk about it, and maybe people need to start changing their tune. It's nice to have ACEP behind us, behind these guidelines saying that, because if just us on the podcast said it, you guys would probably ignore us. But saying that the college is behind it usually will be a step in the right direction. So the last one is avoid IV fluids before doing a trial of oral rehydration therapy in uncomplicated cases of mild to moderate dehydration in children. Piozofran has single-handedly changed the world of pediatric emergency medicine. A little bit of Zofran, apple juice, and suddenly you take a child who looks incredibly ill and make them a child who's trying to get into the sharps box.
Some Zo-N-Go.
Love Zofran, man. I put Zofran in my coffee right next to the ketamine. The important thing with this is that your GI tract does a much better job of rehydrating you than we do through the IV. And in the patients that are too far gone, that aren't making it, or that we try to do some Zofran and give them some PO fluids and they vomit it all up, those patients are going to fail. They need IV fluids. But man, a little bit of Zofran, a popsicle, some EGs. For those of you that didn't know, EGs is actually considered fluids, and that's what all the ENTs send their kids home on, is EGs. It's all made from fruit juice. So I tell parents EGs, juice, popsicles, and they'll be good to go, because their body will take that sugar and take that liquid and do a much better job of rehydrating them than we will with our 20 per kilo boluses.
Would you guys extrapolate this to adults?
I think it's a reasonable trial in adults. I like rectal Phenergan, personally.
Just when you thought it was safe to turn the episode back on with the kids in the car. Thanks, Kevin.
Because I think if you're vomiting and you're unlikely to keep the Zofran down, then you're not going to help anybody. And so I got a box in my fridge. I think the other thing about kids, too, is it not only sparing them the needle stick and the complications associated with that, is you don't have the $1,200 bill associated with the CBC and BMP that comes with putting in an IV.
Yeah, we all assume that we don't give adult patients oral fluids because, well, maybe they'll end up going to the OR or something. But if you think out of every 100 abdominal pain patients you see, how many of them actually go to the OR? I think it's probably 1 out of 100, maybe less.
I was waiting to see number 6 on this list of an IV does not mean BMP and CBC, but I don't think we're quite there yet. You know, think about how hard your nurses try to get one of these IVs to. The kids that needed the IV the most are the ones that are going to be the hardest to get a line in. So I think everybody, even the severely dehydrated kids, as long as they're not an aspiration risk, you can give them a little fluids and see if they'll puff out a bit in order to get a line. If you need the blood for other reasons, you're worried they have an appy, you're worried they're in DKA, something like that. I think that oral rehydration is much better. That's what the World Health Organization recommends, and that's the best way to care for your patient.
How about colysis? Have either of you used colysis before? I did it in a septic ferret once, and it worked great. Any thoughts on that?
I think I'd need to know why the ferret got septic first.
Was he playing with the rectal fenner again?
That's how I administer it.
Wow.
So you're referring to, like, the sub-Q rehydration? Yeah. So what Kevin's referring to is giving hyaluronidase into the sub-Q areas, usually on the back, the buttocks, the chest, and it just kind of breaks up the basement membrane. And then you just put an IV wherever. It doesn't have to be in the vein. You put it into the sub-Q tissue, and you infuse 20 per kilo in a Hunchback of Notre Dame hump into the patient's back. It looks weird. It's very freaky. You kind of have to want to poke the sac, but it actually is effective, and then they'll just absorb it. And what the hyaluronidase does actually is it takes away the pain of injecting all this sub-Q tissue and allows it to kind of extravasate and absorb better. I have never used it. To me, it just freaks me out. I guess a septic ferret, I wouldn't mind trying it in first. So this actually is something that is practiced in various parts of the world and even various parts of the country. I've heard of on EMRAP. I've seen it at some of the conferences. It's just not exactly first-line standard of care. It certainly isn't going to surpass PO fluids. But I think if you do decide to do this, the consent process will probably sound something like this. Mr. Jones, Mrs. Jones, your child is very dehydrated and they need some fluids, but unfortunately we can't get an IV. So we're going to inject some medicine into their butt and then pump this whole bag of fluid into their right butt cheek until they look like a camel with a hump. But don't worry, we've tried this on a septic ferret, and it worked really well. You ever done it?
I've never done it. You know, Ken was here giving that lecture a couple months ago on providing critical care in the resource-limited area, and he talked about doing intraperitoneal fluids, where they put a suprapubic catheter-type catheter in, and there was a 16 French IV or something right below the umbilicus and infused a liter into the peritoneal cavity.
It's like doing a DPL. Most younger physicians haven't done that, but older physicians have put in DPL catheters. When I was an intern, we did them in our sleep.
Well, it brings up a good question about when do you pull the trigger on an IO? You know, the Easy IO company touts the IO as if you can't get an IV on the first stick or whatever, just put in the IO. Mm-hmm. What would you guys do?
So I'll tell you, for me, any kid that comes in that looks like he's going to crash on me, IO. I'll let someone fish around for an IV while I'm putting in the IO. If it's a kid that's dehydrated and their vital signs are stable, they're moderately tachycardic, but they're interactive with their environment, I'll let the nurses try a couple times. I'll give them some Zofran, and you know, we'll see if they can rehydrate themselves that way, and then see if we need to check some labs for why are you so far down? Do you have electrolyte abnormalities? Is your bicarb 8? But the IO in a sick patient, I don't even wait. I just put it in. Usually the recommendations are 60 seconds or 2 IV pokes. I don't bother waiting at this point because by the time someone gets your IV in, you really wish you had that time back.
What about the kid who's just been vomiting for a few days and is so dehydrated they can't get an IV in, but you want labs and all that.
So those are the kids that I'll usually try to rehydrate orally first and then see if we can puff them back up. I just did this with a kid last week who's got trisomy 21 and lots of abdominal surgeries, and he came in not looking that hot. So we gave him some Zofran and a popsicle, and I went to check on him about a half an hour later, and he's sitting up feeling a little bit better, and we were able to get a line in him at that point. He's a really tough stick, too.
How about rectal fluids? That's another great...
Why is everything always about the butt with you?
I'm on a raft in the Pacific Ocean. I've collected some fresh water, but it's full of bird droppings and it's rancid. Drink this and you'd probably vomit and risk worsening dehydration. But there is a way of using it to gain life-giving fluids, but only as a last resort. I'm going to give myself an enema.
And, you know, to go along that same line, dropping an NG tube in one of these kids is also a valid way to get fluids into them. Sometimes the parents would rather an NG than an IV. So that's ACEPS choosing wisely guidelines. So keep those in mind. PO hydration if you can. Avoiding antibiotics on abscesses, and you can slap Jared, Kevin, and my hands if we try to make you give antibiotics. Palliative care, when applicable, avoid the Foleys and avoid the CT scans. Hopefully this is helpful. Well, thank you guys for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this short but hopefully meaningful and helpful episode of AZMcast. We've got some big plans for the year. First thing that we have in mind is deadlines to try to get these out to you in a timely fashion. We've also got some regular segments that we'd like to introduce and have on a regular basis every month that you can be counting on them. And I think overall some of the best segments we've done have been suggested by you guys. So if you have any suggestions, please let me know. If you're having issues downloading the podcast, please let me know, although you probably wouldn't have heard this and you won't be able to let me know. But all in all, we'll see you guys next year. And in closing, we wanna say-